Hi, I'm Tyler Foggett. Join me and my colleagues as we go beyond the headlines and deepen your understanding of the forces shaping our world today on The Political Scene, a newly updated podcast from The New Yorker. With episodes three times each week, The Political Scene accesses the sharpest minds in politics for insight and analysis about everything from abortion rights to the war in Ukraine. Make sure you're following The Political Scene, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
French experts say they've uncovered a large Russian disinformation network targeting not just France, but Germany, Poland, and others.
They also target actually the US and the UK with content that is published in English.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also today, we hear from former National Security Advisor John Bolton, who says his old boss Donald Trump's comments on NATO need to be taken seriously.
He's using this to build an excuse to withdraw from NATO.
And a temple in Taiwan where people ask the divine for help finding romance.
Plus, why on the biggest flower day of the year, Valentine's bouquets from Latin America are fresh.
You harvest the flower, and the next morning, they are in a plane and into Miami within 3 hours.
All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thanks very much for joining us today. Authorities in France say they've uncovered a large-scale Russian disinformation campaign. It allegedly includes nearly 200 websites that were set up to, quote, spread Russian disinformation, and not just in France, but also Germany, Poland, and other parts of Europe.
France says it's being targeted for supporting Ukraine following the Russian invasion. Lou Osborne is a researcher at the Center of Information Resilience in Paris.
It's coming from a French governmental watchdog called Viginum. And basically, their mission is to expose information, hostile information operations that are threatening French interests.
And what kinds of websites did they uncover exactly? Can you give me some examples of what they looked like?
Yes, so they are basically news websites. As you mentioned, a number of them, around 200, they are all connected with each other. And they are basically publishing information, news, mainly about the war in Ukraine. They are badly designed. Sometimes they look like each other. They all have different names. And a number of them are actually now targeting Western countries. So you mentioned France because they publish French content, but they also target actually the US and the UK with content that is published in English.
And were these websites live or were they just ready to launch?
Actually, the network exists since 2013, so it is pretty old. But for 10 years, the network was targeting only domestic audience,
okay,
so Russian and Ukrainian audiences. And since the war in Ukraine, they have switched. And they obviously continue to target Ukraine with anti-Ukrainian government messages. But since June 2023, they launched a new wave of websites that are now targeting Western countries.
And so what points to these being Russian websites specifically? How do we know that Russia is creating them?
So we know that because when you look at how they are made, so their IP address, what type of what we call certificate they use, so to make the website functioning, all of these technical indicators are actually leading us to Russia.
So now that this Russian disinformation campaign targeting many Western countries has been uncovered, what is the French government doing about it?
What is important, and this is what the French government is doing, is to expose those networks, because they may seem small, like 200 news portals that not a lot of people have heard about. It may seem insignificant, but actually there are many networks. They are not the only one. And it's really the multiplication of those websites that have a very long-term impact on Western society by, you know, trying to polarize communities, by trying to destroy social unity and as well the trust in institution, in the media. And that's really that kind of awareness that the French government is building.
So these sites are targeting lots of countries, not just France. But can you talk to me about how big of a issue disinformation in France is specifically right now?
So that's a real issue, as you mentioned, in many ways. because it amplifies how society or how communities can be opposing each other. That's often working as an amplificator element to social discontent or to breakage within the social network within society in France. It's also a lot of countries, not only France, there are, you know, some elections that are upcoming. So that has been already an element that has influence on election or that have tried to influence election. And influence operations are also used to really destroy, like with no specific objective, but destroying the trust in institution. And that's really, that has been for a very long time, the primary objective of Russian influence operation.
This has become a persistent problem across Western democracies, Russian interference in elections. You know, we've seen it here in the U.S. What do governments need to do to counteract this sort of thing effectively?
So there is a multiplication of sources that and of media that have a strong methodology and ethics to journalism. That's the first thing. And it's also the ability to monitor what's going on during election and to be able to denounce it. And more government, Western government, but not only, also governments, for instance, in Africa, are trying to put in place such mechanism of groups that are going to monitor the media landscape and the information landscape to be able to expose any attempt of interfering.
We've heard for several years now about Russian disinformation efforts. Do you worry that the public is starting to tune this out? Like, yeah, we've heard this before.
I think that's a possibility. There is a kind of fatigue of hearing that it's always Russian disinformation. And to be honest, that has also been used by politicians to try to justify some of their own mistakes. But I think that's also on what Russia is betting, that really long-term action to kind of make people a bit brainless, if you want. And this is when we need to remember that such hostile action are really detrimental to us, to our own freedom, to our own kind of judgment on what's going on in our country. The more engaged citizens of a country are, the more resilient the society is going to be towards information operation.
Lou Osborne is a researcher who specializes in Russian influence at the Center of Information Resilience in Paris. She's explaining the news today that French authorities have uncovered a large-scale Russian disinformation campaign.
If you're in the middle of a long, cold winter, white sands with turquoise waters might sound pretty good. It is high season in the Caribbean, and the beaches on the islands of Jamaica and the Bahamas are especially inviting. Both countries get several million tourists every year, most from the U.S. and Canada. But the State Department has issued a warning about rising crime in both places, which is raising concerns about just how safe these vacation spots are for visitors. From Miami, the world's TBC Isaiah reports.
The U.S. travel warnings seem to be reasonable. Jamaica has one of the highest homicide rates in the Western Hemisphere.
The country is a perfect transshipment point for cocaine, and it is a very large grower of marijuana.
Chris Dalby is the director of World of Crime, a think tank focused on organized crime.
And its proximity to the U.S. mainland mean that it is very easy to traffic drugs one way and traffic weapons the other way.
This all leads to a lot of gang activity in Jamaica, Dalby says. Since 2022, the State Department recommends visitors to reconsider traveling to Jamaica. It's called a Level 3 warning. And in late January, it added a security update saying, quote, violent crimes such as home invasions, armed robberies, sexual assaults, and homicides are common. Sexual assaults occur frequently, including at all-inclusive resorts.
In the case of Jamaica, everything that the U.S. Travel Advisory says is true. The crimes that it points out do happen.
But in reality, tourists are rarely affected. The Jamaican Tourism Board says the crime rate against visitors is only 0.01%. The board is pushing back against the new U.S. travel advisory in a public statement, saying that serious crime actually declined 20% recently thanks to police improvements. The U.S. also issued a recent security alert for the Bahamas. It warns about 18 murders that have happened in the capital of Nassau since January. Chris Dalby says sudden crime spikes are common in small Caribbean islands.
But these spikes tend to rise and fall fairly quickly. Because overall, we're talking about a small number of homicides. Even a relatively small rise in the number of homicides can be significant in terms of percentages.
2 weeks ago, something else happened in the Bahamas that made headlines.
Two women were drugged and assaulted while on vacation in the Bahamas, unaware the State Department had issued a travel advisory in the area.
Two American tourists told Good Morning America that their cocktails were spiked with drugs.
After the first drink, we had to get out of the ocean because we noticed that it was just hitting so hard.
The women said members of the resort staff sexually assaulted them after they lost consciousness. An investigation is underway by the Bahamas Police Department, and two men were arrested. The Office of the Prime Minister of the Bahamas said in a statement that this incident, along with those described in the latest U.S. crime alert, do not reflect general safety in the Bahamas. On a scale from 1 to 4, the Bahamas got a level 2 warning by the U.S. State Department. Other countries with the same security qualification include Costa Rica and the Dominican Republic. They both get a lot of tourists, and most people experience safe vacations there. Chris Dalby says it's good to take precautions.
I would not recommend to any tourist to walk around Montego Bay or Kingston alone or at night.
Those are Jamaican cities. The U.S. State Department also recommends being aware of your surroundings and keeping a low profile. For The World, I'm Tibisa Isea.
We wanted to share with you this note about the recent passing of an acclaimed American opera singer. She found fame through a popular French movie. In 1981, when the world came to know Wilhelmina Wiggins Fernandez, she was already an accomplished soprano. Fernandez Smith, her married name, was from Philadelphia and studied there at the Academy of Vocal Arts before going on to Juilliard, then making her debut with the Houston Grand Opera in the 70s.
In 1979, while singing La Bohème with Placido Domingo in Paris, French filmmakers approached her about appearing in a new movie, to be directed by the neo-noir filmmaker Jean-Jacques Benex. Diva is a thriller and opens with Fernandez Smith performing that aria by Alfredo Catalani. In the film, a bootleg recording of her performance becomes the centerpiece of attention.
Nicole vous a donné quelque chose?
Non, c'est moi qui dois vous donner quelque chose.
Me donner?
Diva took off globally and launched Fernandez Smith into unexpected and not necessarily intended fame. She avoided the limelight, and ironically, so did the character she played in the movie Diva. Here she is while being pursued by an unlikely groupie, a young French mail carrier.
Je m'excuse.
I can't believe it. Vous me prenez pour les Beatles? Je ne suis pas un chanteuse disco.
Opera houses around the world suddenly wanted to hear this soprano who graced the silver screen. Fernandez Smith ultimately left the stage and joined her husband in Lexington, Kentucky, where he was running the voice program at Kentucky State.
Modest to the very end, the obituary in the local Lexington paper identified Fernandez Smith with her most recent profession, special education teacher at the local elementary school. Her quarter century of performances at opera houses around the globe did not go unnoticed, though, in Lexington. Wilhelmina Fernandez Smith also led the children's choir at her church. She died on February 2nd at the age of 75.
Coming up next, a behind-the-scenes look at where all those Valentine's Day flowers are grown and how they land at your neighborhood florist, still fresh, as they say, as a daisy.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Video from Miami International Airport this week showing workers there inspecting fresh-cut Valentine's Day flowers arriving from Latin America. Almost 90% of the flowers sold on this holiday enter the U.S. via Miami. They're from countries like Ecuador and Colombia. Victor Giorgini is president and CEO of Equiflow Rio Roses. They grow flowers across South America, and they also import. You are in Miami, Victor. How busy has it been?
Very busy. We had had a very busy season, lots of challenges with the weather and production. And like always, demand goes up so much that we also had some logistic challenges, having enough service with airlines being able to bring the flowers into the country.
When you say demand goes up so much, what are we talking about? What do you prepare for?
We prepare for about 4 to 5 times what we sell on a regular basis on a month for the holiday.
Wow, that's a lot.
For the Valentine's holiday. Yeah, it is a lot, and it takes a lot on the employees. It takes a lot on the farms. Just to give you an idea, a rose cycle for harvesting is about 72 days on average. There are longer varieties of roses, they're shorter. Just to make it quick, you sacrifice all the production of part of the month of November, all of December, the first 15 days of January to be able to harvest that rose for Valentine's. And once you harvest that rose for Valentine's, you sacrifice all of the production of February 14 on until the next 72 days where the flowers come back.
So I'm curious, what does that look like in places like Colombia and Ecuador, from exploiting larger fields to just hiring more labor?
It is challenging, but there's labor available. There is a very large pool of labor available. It is hard to find and to sustain people, but you need to go and find additional people. Now, there's a lot of machinery being used right now to try to deal with the volume, but it's not an easy task. And the same thing happens in the United States with retailers and wholesalers trying to find additional help.
I mean, other times of year when inventory is average, I imagine flowers move out of the cooler, but not as quickly as now. Still, I'm wondering how through the entire supply chain and shipping, how all these flowers stay fresh.
The movement is very quickly. Let me tell you something. At any time of the year, you harvest the flower this morning, you do the proper post-harvest process, hydration, and the next morning, they are on a plane and into Miami within 3 hours. From Miami to anywhere in the country, you can have flowers either through using next day delivery, through using a delivery by plane, or to using the traditional, which is transportation and specialized trucks for the floral industry. They can put a flower from Miami to New York in about 30 hours, or even to the West Coast in less than 3 days.
What are the most popular flowers for Valentine's Day, and where are they grown?
Roses.
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 Yeah, I mean, I figured, but I mean, does anything come in even close second place?
No, not really. In volume, no. In demand, either. Sometimes we run out of flowers. The industry runs out of flowers when the demand is high.
Is Valentine's Day celebrated in like Ecuador, Colombia?
Yes, it is. It is not to the degree we do. But yes, it is. Not only in Latin America, they also celebrate it in multiple countries around the globe.
Victor, you are the head of your company. Have you ever slipped up and not gotten your loved one flowers on Valentine's Day? Because you don't really have an excuse, do you?
No, I don't have an excuse. I've been doing this for too long, unfortunately. I don't have an excuse. I always find something.
Be like Victor. Victor Giorgini is president and CEO of Equiflow Rio Roses, telling us what happens behind the scenes in the international flower trade ahead of Valentine's Day.
The Marshall Islands is one of the most remote places on Earth, a chain of atolls and islands between Hawaii and the Philippines. The area was once used to test the atomic bomb, and now it's under threat from rising seas. Tens of thousands of Marshallese have migrated to the U.S. One group has settled in the city of Salina in northwestern Ohio. We're passing on the culture of the islands to the next generation is a priority. The Ohio Newsroom's Kendall Crawford reports.
Michael Capelli has spent much of his life listening to the stories of older relatives of what life was like in the Marshall Islands. He's never been, but his parents have passed down its traditions and history.
We sail around the seas, and we don't need navigational tools. And that's what sets us apart. We're the people of the sea.
Landlocked Ohio looks a lot different. Still, a small community of islanders have settled in Salina. There's no official count on their numbers there. City officials estimate around 1,500. But Capelli thinks it's double that. He says the younger generation here is growing, but their knowledge of Marshallese culture is fading.
We can't get to the point where our kids, all of them, don't know how to speak Marshallese. They don't know our stories, and they don't know our values.
So in October, Capelli founded the Ohio Marshallese Youth Center.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and do a roll call real quick.
9 teenagers are huddled around a table, scribbling notes and sipping Kool-Aid. Their attention is turned to a Zoom screen, where an instructor from Pacific Island Linguistic Services is teaching them ways to greet each other in Marshallese. How to say hello, how are you, where they're from. But he's not just offering translations. He's teaching them about the island's matriarchal clans, the values of their ancestors, the traditions behind the text.
Our greeting was a very powerful and intentional, filled with love, filled with beauty, filled with...
Preserving this culture is difficult, but important, especially because many Marshallese people didn't choose to come to the U.S. Decades ago, they were displaced. In the 1940s and 50s, the U.S. used part of the islands to test nuclear weapons.
In 1946, Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands was the scene of the first of these tests. This was Operation Crossroads.
Those detonations have done lasting harm to the islands and the Marshallese people, and they contributed to emigration from their native land. That's why classes like this are so important.
How are you?
Many of the students speak Marshallese at home with their families, but beyond that, it's hard to find spaces to connect with their culture. That's true for Miko Yasawa, who moved to Ohio 7 years ago. She joined the new language class so she could understand her manit. That's the Marshallese word for culture. But it means more than that. One Marshallese essayist describes it as the core of our being, the spirit in our walk.
Us kids in this generation, like, we don't really follow that expectation, and like we just like ignore it. And so for us to like spread it out, we need to learn more about it.
That's exactly what Capelli wants, for students to get joy and pride from their heritage, like he does.
The Marshall Islands could sink, but I feel like it would always be with me. Marshall Islands is not a land, it's almost like just a people.
For The World, I'm Kendall Crawford.
More global news and stories are still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. Looking for a job while learning a new language is not so easy. Claritza Abreu has been there.
So I said, Claritza, you gotta do something. It occurred to me to grab the white pages. Do you remember those?
How studying the phone book helped her learn English and land the job she needed. That and more still ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The West African nation of Senegal was supposed to hold presidential elections on February 25th, but the current president, Macky Sall, has delayed voting until December. That has angered many Senegalese, and they're taking to the streets in protest. This might not be news in many places, but Senegal has a reputation for being a stable democracy with relatively smooth transitions of power. Kelly Duke Bryant is a history professor at Rowan University in New Jersey with a focus on Senegal. The Senegalese constitution, Kelly, limits presidents to 2 terms in office. Macky Sall has served 2 terms already. Is the thinking that Macky Sall is looking for a backdoor path to changing the rules and getting a 3rd term?
There are folks who are calling this a constitutional coup, that essentially he is trying to remain in office well beyond the end of his mandate, which was supposed to come to an end in April, by delaying the election until December. If the election actually goes forward in December, as they're saying that it will, the earliest a new person would be installed in the presidency would be in 2025. So that would essentially give Macky Sall an additional nearly a year in office. And so there are folks in Senegal who are saying that that's really what's at work here.
Well, Senegal's reputation, as you know, is stability. How unusual is this seemingly halted transfer of power for Senegal?
Senegal does have a reputation as a beacon of democracy in the region, a region that has been beset with numerous coups in the last several years. So it's really important as a place of democracy and as an American ally. Senegal has had two successful elections with transitions of power from one official to another, from one party to another. That was in 2000 and then again in 2012 when Macky Sall was elected. And so that's really a good record. It shows that there is a movement towards secure and safe democracy in Senegal, which has, of course, been independent from French colonial rule since 1960.
Now, in recent days, there have been protests, largely student demonstrations. How unusual is that for Senegal?
Well, there's been a long history, actually, of youth leadership in protests in Senegal, going back at least to the early 20th century. During the colonial period, a group of young people called the Jeunes Senegalais, the young Senegalese, who were very active in politics and calling for significant reforms to French colonial rule and in calling for the election of their preferred candidate. As part of the sort of global protest movement of 1968, Senegal had its own 1968 moment. And then again in the late 1980s with a movement called Set Setal, which was an effort to both kind of clean up the environment and clean up politics, which was really led by youth. So you have seen this trend of youth really pushing for change. And I think that's what we're seeing right now with the student-led protests and youth-led protests happening in Senegal.
And is it just about President Macky Sall delaying the election, or are these young protesters angry about something else?
Yeah, I think it's about the delay of the election, but I think that really does speak to a larger issue of their disillusionment with Senegalese political figures not making good on promises to restructure the economy in such a way that it would allow for more formal employment for young people. The population under the age of 25, that accounts for 60% of the total of the 18.3 million people in the country, and there's very high youth unemployment. And that means that there are many, many young people who just don't see a workable future for themselves in the country. It leads to many people taking the risk of migrating overseas, whether it's legally or illegally. And there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the lack of jobs, especially jobs in the formal sector for young people.
So, Kelly, given that Senegal is having the shakiness around its elections, what could it potentially mean for the region, which, as you pointed out, has seen a string of military coups in the last year or so?
It is very risky for the region, I think. There have not only been coups, but in the three countries where there are military juntas that are currently in power, Burkina Faso, Niger, and Mali, they recently, just last month, withdrew from ECOWAS, which is a regional both security and economic bloc. And so I think that seeing another conflict like this, another kind of inflection point like this in Senegal right now, it's really problematic for ECOWAS, especially since ECOWAS is attempting to be involved as an intermediary in trying to bring the election to fruition on the original timetable.
Kelly Duke Bryant is a history professor and Senegal expert at Rowan University in New Jersey, explaining the recent events that have undermined the country's reputation for democratic stability.
A $95 billion funding package for Ukraine faces an uncertain path in Congress. The measure passed the Senate early this morning after an overnight debate. This afternoon, President Biden urged Republicans in the House to send the bill to his desk.
Supporting this bill is standing up to Putin. Opposing it is playing into Putin's hands.
Ukrainians are watching the debate closely. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky welcomed the Senate's move, saying on social media that U.S. funding saves lives in Ukraine. In Lviv, Mayor Andriy Sadavy said the U.S. and Ukraine are partners.
America and Ukraine together build future forward and show good example about partnership. I love America.
The $95 billion aid package would be spent mostly on American-made military equipment for Ukraine.
Donald Trump's recent comments about NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, continue to bring condemnation. Trump has never been a fan of NATO. Still, U.S. allies were taken aback this weekend when Trump said he would encourage Russia to, quote, do whatever the hell they want to countries that are, quote, delinquent on defense payments. NATO members have agreed to spend 2% of their GDP on defense. It's the largest military bloc in history and was founded to defend Western democracies based on the idea that an attack on one is an attack on all. John Bolton served at the White House as President Trump's national security advisor. He told me earlier today that Trump is determined to pull the U.S. out of NATO.
When he's bringing it up again in this context and the comments he made about letting the Russians do whatever the hell they want to do, take him very seriously. He will do this if he is elected president.
So this is all relevant, of course, because Donald Trump is the clear front runner in the Republican primary race. I want to focus on another implication in those comments. When he almost encouraged Russia to attack members of NATO, what does that mean for this security alliance?
Well, I think it has a devastating impact, even though Trump is not already elected. It demonstrates, in my mind, why Trump is simply not fit to be president. He does not understand what's at stake in international relations. He doesn't understand why the security of the United States itself depends on strong, coherent presidential leadership, and why it's why if he's elected to a second term, I'm very much afraid he'll do a lot more damage than he did in the first term.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that rhetoric like Trump's undermines the alliance and puts European and American troops at risk. But Republican leaders don't seem to be alarmed by President Trump's comments. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I think a lot of Republican leaders are alarmed. Some are not because they're intimidated by Trump. Some tend to discount what he says since much of it is simply untrue and fantasizing. And it is sometimes a chore, I will acknowledge, to separate the fantasy from the reality. This is real. This threat to withdraw from NATO is real. So when Marco Rubio said a few days ago that this was just a way of bargaining with the Europeans to try and get their defense expenditures up, that's just simply not true. And Marco professes not to be worried about Trump withdrawing, but he needs to explain, if he's not worried, why some weeks and months ago he worked on legislation that has been adopted by Congress to try and prevent Trump from any future president from withdrawing from NATO without congressional approval. There is nobody else out there other than Donald Trump suggesting withdrawal from NATO.
Are these comments changing NATO or the way that U.S. interacts with its European allies?
I think from things Europeans have said publicly and from what some of them have said to me, that they're very worried about what Trump's saying, given the prospects he'll be elected. There's a lot of happy talk out there among Europeans that this is really a good thing. Now Europe can detach itself from lines on the United States and defend Europe just on its own, to have the European Union do it. That is another fantasy. The big European countries are still not even able to meet their commitment from 2014 to get to 2% defense spending on GDP.
I'm curious, Ambassador Bolton, if you watched much of Tucker Carlson's marathon conversation with Vladimir Putin, and if you did, what went through your head as you were watching that?
I watched parts of it. I mean, look, Tucker's a dilettante. I think Putin knows that. It was a great propaganda forum for Putin. He got to lecture the world on Russian history and make his points about Ukraine. I think one substantive point that came out of it that I've been worried about for some time is Putin indicating a willingness to negotiate about Ukraine, because I'm afraid what will happen, as we're in election context in the United States, you would freeze the conflict along existing lines of control, and as negotiations dragged on, that would become Russia's new border for Ukraine. I think the Biden administration, faced now with two ongoing wars, would love to try and get both of them put on ice for the election. I worry about European resolve when it comes to Ukraine. So I'm afraid Putin may have made a ploy here. We'll see how it plays out.
I want to switch gears now to talk about the war in Gaza. During the Trump presidency, the U.S. really stopped trying to work toward a negotiated two-state solution. Looking at what's happening now in the Middle East, do you think that was a mistake?
No, because the two-state solution, frankly, was dead before October the 7th, and if it wasn't, it's definitely dead now. Israel is not going to agree to the formation of a state on its borders that could be controlled by terrorists. So I think we've been pursuing an impossible objective for a long time, and the administration's continued pursuit of it now only makes resolving this conflict more difficult.
How do you think a second Trump administration would handle the war in Gaza?
Well, I don't know, because I don't think Trump follows policies as we normally consider them in Washington. I don't think he has a philosophy. I think the answer to your question is what Trump thinks is in his personal interest at the particular point where you ask him the question.
John Bolton served as national security advisor under President Trump, and he's the author of The Room Where It Happened, a White House memoir.
In the Eastern religion of Taoism, there isn't a single god, but many. Taoists might pray to a particular god if they're having money troubles, another god if they need to pass a big exam, still another if they're looking for love. There's one Taoist deity specializing in the romantic lives of LGBTQ followers, with one shrine devoted to that god. The World's Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen reports.
In the outskirts of Taipei, on the eighth floor of an otherwise drab office building, there is an oasis of serenity. Where you might expect to find a small office space, there is a temple with wooden floors and red and gold banners. I'm here to meet Tuor, otherwise known as the Rabbit God. There are hundreds of spiritual deities in Taoism, some associated with animals, a tiger or a turtle, but this temple holds a shrine for the Rabbit God, favored by LGBTQ Taoists in Taiwan. They pray to him for good luck in the realm of romance. But there's a certain technique for making wishes to the Rabbit God. One of the temple's disciples is showing me how it's done.
Oh, my name's Dean. Yes, I'm a disciple of our master.
Dean Yang helps to maintain the only well-known shrine to the Rabbit God. I see it against the wall, a wooden table topped with a gold-colored urn. Inside of it, three sticks of incense. Yang lights the incense and tells me to kneel before the shrine. Then he hands me two curved pieces of wood, shaped like half moons. These are moon blocks for divining whether the Rabbit God will grant someone's wish. I'm supposed to cast them towards the shrine.
Slightly toss it into the air.
Yeah. Onto the ground?
Yeah, onto the ground.
Okay.
You have nine chances.
Okay.
Nine chances to find out if Tuor, the Rabbit God, will grant my wish. Each moon block has two sides, one curved, one flat. They both have to land in a certain way, one side up, the other side down, to confirm the deity's approval. And they have to land like that three times in a row. Nice. That's one yes. Disciple Dean Yang says, don't get too excited. Getting three in a row is hard. That's another yes. One more, and my wish is granted. But I should back up, because actually it's not my wish. I'm here to make a wish for someone else, someone I met the day before.
Hello, my name is Zeno, and I'm 24 years old.
Zeno is what everyone calls him, except for his family. I'm not going to share his proper name because Zeno is not fully out to his mom and dad.
They think I will have a girlfriend and I will marry to a girl, but I will not.
Zeno says he's only attracted to men. He's been coming to this temple to beseech the Rabbit God for a boyfriend.
I hope you can bring a boy to me, and he's a smart guy and he loves reading. Maybe he likes drink coffee. And hope he's an adorable guy and a good-looking guy, yes.
With his friends at his barista job, Zeno is openly gay. Taiwan is one of the few places in Asia that firmly upholds LGBTQ rights, including same-sex marriage. But even at Taoist temples, there might be a shrine to Ye Lao, the go-to saint for romantic matters. But Zeno says, he's mostly for straight people.
Just Rabbit God is for the LGBTQ+ community. There's no God like this.
Here's the problem. Zeno came to see the Rabbit God more than a year ago, and later he did find a boyfriend. But Zeno says he didn't properly appreciate his boyfriend, taking him for granted. They broke up. Now he fears the Rabbit God is upset with him.
Yeah, maybe a Rabbit God saying I'm a loser.
But Zeno wonders, could his luck turn around if someone talks to the Rabbit God on his behalf? So that's why I'm here, rattling moon blocks in my hands. I'm hoping for a third successful roll. I need just one more to make a request of Tuor, the Rabbit God.
That's three.
Well, very lucky for you.
That's good.
Very lucky for you.
Very fortunate. So you can have three bows and show your gratitude to Rabbi God first.
Okay. Disciple Yang says, put the blocks down, close your eyes, and make your most critical wish.
Greetings, tour. My most critical wish, what I would like to ask of you, is to bring romance into my friend Zeno's life. Thank you.
Will it work? Well, Zeno admitted to me he isn't totally sure there's a supernatural deity hearing his desires.
Maybe he's listening. I don't know, but my heart is feel very quiet and I'm very happy. That's the important thing. Yeah.
And if Zeno does find a boyfriend, he promises to bring him here to the temple and give thanks to Tur, the rabbit god. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, New Taipei City, Taiwan.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Moving to a new country and establishing yourself in a career can be daunting, and often just getting a foot in the door relies on the help of friends and family. That was true for Claritza Abreu. Today, she's a leading IT and business consultant in Massachusetts. But when she first came to the U.S. as a young woman, she found it hard to get her start. Here's Abreu sharing her experience with the storytelling project Stories from the Stage.
I come to Boston from Dominican Republic with one suitcase. My suitcase was full of books and many dreams. It was a very heavy suitcase. When Dominicans emigrate to the United States, we give away all our clothes and our belongings. We say, why bring in stuff to a country where we're going to find everything we need? And plus, bikinis have no place in the middle of the winter. I had just gotten married and come here to start my new family. My husband had immigrated here a year before with his family and was working as a KitchenAid at a local nursing home. I had learned English in high school, and I had just graduated from a bachelor's degree in computer science engineering. So I'm thinking, I'm going to Boston. I'm going to find a job as soon as possible. I start sending my resume everywhere, but I don't hear from anybody. And I'm wondering, what is going on? I cannot understand what is going on. But I also didn't have anybody to ask. So the only person I knew had a professional job was my cousin Angela, who was working as an administrative assistant at a local daycare center. And she said, of course, I can refer you to my former boss. She's looking for a part-time bilingual receptionist. And I said, of course I can do that. When I get to the interview, I meet Kathy, the manager. She was a long hair, hippie style. So she just wanted to offer me the job right away. And then she says, but you still have to interview with my executive director. She's a little bit intimidating, but don't worry, you'll be just fine. So I get very excited. I get a nice professional suit, and I head to the second interview with the executive director. A very tall woman, big personality, middle-aged, expressionless white woman. She asked me all sorts of questions, and I'm answering very nervous. I answered them all. A few days go by, and Kathy calls me and said, Claritza, you got the job. And I'm like, yes. So I start my job, and 2 weeks go by, and the executive director comes back from vacation. She walks in through the front door, with her big bags, her big personality, and she looks surprised and a little bit upset. She stares at me for a few minutes, and she goes upstairs. Needless to say that I'm nervous. Soon enough, I find out that she had told Kathy not to hire me because I didn't speak good English. So at this point, Kathy thought that because of my education and my energy, I was going to be able to do this job and, of course, gain the confidence of the executive director. And I have to confess that I also thought I could do the job. Soon enough, I realized I couldn't do that job. Some of you may not know that in Spanish, words are spelled the same way as they sound. We don't have to deal with those damn silent vowels that you have in English. And plus, when you're learning a new language, the processing time in your brain is much slower. So I was struggling. I was disappointed with my own performance because I couldn't pick up messages and the spell of the names of the callers soon enough before they would hang up on me or get upset, because I had to ask them over and over again. So I knew I was in trouble. So I said, Claritza, you gotta do something. It occurred to me to grab the white pages. Do you remember those? I grabbed that book and walked down the street to the only person who spoke English in the family, my 12-year-old niece, Melissa. And I said, Melly, can you please dictate names and number of the book so I can learn how to pick up messages? And she's like, of course, dear. So for 2 or 3 weeks, we sat down every night for her to dictate names and numbers, and I became a master speller. I was so proud of myself. I thought I had secured my job. So I'm come happy to my job every day, but one day, that proved that that was not enough. Kathy comes down the stairs with tears in her eyes, and she said, Claritza, the executive director have eliminated your position. I still can feel the sadness and despair of that moment. By then, I was 4 months pregnant with my first son. And just the thought that I couldn't provide for my son and being able to pay rent, that as it is, a part-time $10 an hour job, I was making more money than my husband with a minimum wage KitchenAid job. I picked up my stuff, I went home and cried. I cried and cried and cried, I just couldn't believe it. And I picked up myself a couple of days later and I said, you know what, I'm applying for new jobs. A women's organization out of all places called me up for an interview. And I went to the interview, and when they saw me pregnant, they looked at me like I had 3 heads, and I never heard from them. Days went by, weeks went by, and I still cannot believe, up to this moment, that her executive director herself called me back, and she asked me to come back. And this time, she offered me a full-time job. I heard there was a lot of chaos in the front office, and people were just asking, where is Claritza, where is Claritza? I worked there 1 more year, and as you remember, I was a computer engineer. So I developed a software for them, and I used that experience as a reference to get my first software developer job. Fast forward many years later, I am an executive at technology companies, and I have my own company. So my story reminds me that we always have to be understanding and tolerant of others because we really don't know the trials and challenges that they're going through.
Claritza Abreu is a tech consultant in Massachusetts. She told her story on the program Stories from the Stage from our GBH partners at World TV. Learn more at worldchannel.org.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.